periodically turn the chat box on and off. When we're not when we're discussing non-appeal business, we'll leave it open. But then when we are hearing an appeal, we will close the chat box. We wanted to, in order to allow for any points of order that need to be brought up while the chat box is closed, please use the raise hand feature if you would like to make a point of order. Otherwise, we will reopen it back up when it's we are not in the appeal, and of course when we're in public comment, and we will save all of the records from the chat. All of our meetings are recorded with a few exceptions, and only non-appeal meetings will be broadcasted. So this is an appeal meeting, so it's not broadcasted on our Facebook page, but it is being recorded for our records. If you have any questions about any of these rules, that now is the time while the chat box is open to ask them. Please use the send to all participants and panelists in case people are asking questions that other people want answered so everyone can see the questions. Okay. And one thing I forgot to say was, hello, this is the September 2nd Citizen Review Committee meeting for the record. I kind of got ahead of myself there. We have one set of minutes to approve before we go on. So we've got the August 5th, 2020 minutes, which I hope people have reviewed. Yes. Great. Can I get a motion for minutes approval?
I move that we approve the minutes.
Second. Okay, Vadim, and seconded by Julie. Is that you?
No.
Oh.
But I can't.
Okay. Julie, you are seconding it. Great. We'll go ahead and take a vote. Hold on, give me 1 second though to catch up on my sheet here. Okay. Voting. I will start and say yay. Jihan.
Yes.
Julie.
Yes.
Sylvan.
Yes.
Taylor.
Yes.
Vadim.
Yes.
Okay. With a vote of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 0, 0, that passes. So August 5th minutes are approved. Okay. And then actually, I think I got it wrong on my thing here. David, is IPR's report first? Yes. Okay. I put it wrong on my personal sheet. My bad. Ross or Dana?
Hello. I'll go through. Dana can jump in on anything she wants to, obviously. So director's report, and David, did we put a link in the chat so everybody can get a look at this if they want to? I think that's what we've been doing for the rest.
Yep. It's on there.
So, we obviously continue to, be operating with the COVID-19 restrictions. So everybody's still working from home. We are still taking complaints from people online, via Trackit forms online, via email, and over the phone. If anybody is listening and is not familiar with our process, if you send us something on Twitter, it's really helpful if you can actually contact us and fill out the complaint form or give us a call. A lot of times Twitter does not allow us to figure out who took the video originally, if this is a protest video, or to figure out who some of the people are that we need to reach out to. So, if anybody's not familiar with our process and you want to file a complaint with IPR, I would just encourage you to use one of those methods that I mentioned before. Let's see, community outreach. We've got I skipped policy reviews. Policy reviews, we had a weapon flashlight policy review came out last month. That's on our website if anyone hasn't had a chance to look at it yet. Under community outreach, Irene, who is not able to be here tonight, she's talked to a fair amount of folks. That's all kind of listed there in that paragraph. So please refer to that for more information. And then the OIR report, for anybody who's not aware of this, OIR is an organization out of Los Angeles that we contract with, and they put out annual reports around officer-involved shootings. We would have already released this report, and when the report comes out, the OIR group flies up from LA and they do a presentation to city council. They also do kind of a community meeting where people from the community can come and ask questions about the report. They can voice any concerns that they have, anything like that. We held off on that kind of early on because everybody had been sent home, and we really thought that the community meeting would not be as good done this way as it is live, which I still think is true, but we clearly aren't going to be back to working from home. All right, we're not going to be back to working in the office anytime soon. We're not going to be able to have any public meetings that OIR could attend. So we now have that on the agenda after some negotiating of schedules in the last month. We've got that on the city council agenda for September 30th, and we will be putting that report out 2 weeks before. So I think our plan is to put that out on the 15th. If anyone's interested in that, the OIR report is extremely comprehensive. If I remember right, it's been a lot of months since I read it now, but it's around 110, 120 pages, something like that. And it's a comprehensive review of kind of all aspects of officer-involved shootings and then the sort of the processes that surround those. So it's a lot of good information. It really, really, really is a deep, deep dive. So we hope that people will, we're still working on getting the community meeting scheduled, and unfortunately it will have to be in a Zoom format, but we would really encourage anyone who's interested to take a look at that report if possible and come to that meeting with questions for the OIR folks that put that report together. Let's see, what else do we have in here? I think that the last thing we have is just caseload counts. So at the bottom of the director's report, you can see kind of a snapshot of where we're at currently. Just a word about that. This is kind of a snapshot. We continue to have more cases coming in all the time, some of them from things that just happened in recent days. Most of those are related to the protests. A very high number of those are about use of force, which means that they are very likely to go to a full administrative investigation. And those take quite a while to get done often. So those cases won't be wrapped up for a while, but we do, you know, when you look at those numbers, please just keep in mind that that is kind of a snapshot and that a lot of those cases that are, for instance, at the intake phase will move on to the full investigation phase. So those numbers will change quite a bit. You know, if the protests were ending tomorrow, we would have probably a better idea of what the total amount of kind of protest-related investigations that we have, but that certainly doesn't seem like it's going to happen. So I think those numbers are just going to kind of continue to go up. I think that's what we've got for our part. Dana, is there anything that you would want to add? Or David, is there anything that you would want to add?
Nope, I think that's pretty comprehensive.
Okay. Any questions from CRC folks? Okay, thank you much. If any questions come up later, you can always please send an email. Thanks.
Thank you. I have my report next, but real quick, David, getting an email from Debbie Iona, also having trouble. It seems like Mr. Handelman is in here, but...
Debbie, I think Debbie was able to get hers to work, so she just sent me an email saying she was able to get it to work, so...
Oh, I do see her now in the chat. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, this issue will be resolved at the next CRC meeting. I think I know what the problem is.
Okay. Thank you. Just want to make sure that was taken care of. All right. let me pull up my sheet here. Okay. So for my report, a couple of things. I do have some resignation letters that I will be reading into the record. So why don't we just go ahead and start with that? So our first resignation from Hillary Huck. Reads, to whom it may concern, I am writing to resign from my position on the Citizen Review Committee. I joined in early 2018 with hopes to be a part of building accountability and playing a small part of oversight and justice in our policing system. Being on the CRC requires an intense time commitment, and I spent many hours each month dedicated to it as part of community service and with a belief in the work we were doing. I was dismayed by the mayor's reaction and the ultimate consequence for the officer involved in a case our committee and the rest of city council saw as clear retaliation. Mayor Wheeler questioned why we would even have a citizen committee that could overturn decisions made by the chief of police. This piece covered it nicely, and they linked a link to a Portland Mercury article. I'll paste this text in the chat in a second. In a time that police accountability is ever more important, I can no longer be a part of a group that is undermined by the mayor or the chief of police. It is unfortunate that the CRC is not given more power, as it could easily be restructured to fulfill its mission and be a true place for social justice. It has an incredible group of committed people serving our community, and I hope they can feel their commitment to change is respected, as they will undoubtedly see many complaints filed in the coming weeks and months. Footage and news coverage of police action since the protests began around 100 days ago show many criminal behaviors that deserve reprimand. If I had more faith that the process would not be undermined, I would be proud to continue to serve on the CRC to give a sense of justice to my fellow community members. Staff at IPR have been supportive, especially Irene and David, and there are many amazing community members connected to CopWatch and League of Women Voters, among others, who are invaluable to the process. I want to thank you all. Sincerely, Hillary Huck. And she also said, hi, David, Irene, and Candace, please forward to community members and CRC. Thank you. The next resignation we got earlier today, that was Hillary's was yesterday. Today we got one from Adam Green, one of our newer members. And it reads, to Chair Avalos, fellow CRC members, and dedicated IPR staff, this letter is to serve as my resignation from the Citizen Review Committee, effective immediately. I have spent 7 years volunteering for the City of Portland. I truly believe my voice on the Police Review Board and CRC would help, in a small way, support a more just and accountable bureau. I believed real change could occur in the current system. I no longer feel that way. The events of this past weekend were a tipping point for me. We continue to witness excessive force used by officers on the streets. Members of the media continue to be threatened. Armed Trump supporters are allowed to parade through downtown Portland while pointing guns at people that aren't wearing Trump gear. These are just a few examples of a failed system with failed leadership. I can no longer support the system in any way. I wish you success with whatever comes next. Sincerely, Adam Green. And then lastly, from Carol, which came shortly after Adam's, that said, good morning or good afternoon. I regret to inform you that I'm resigning my position on the CRC board. It has been my pleasure to work with each of you, and I wish you all the very best in your efforts to promote police accountability and reform. Sincerely, Carol. So I wanted to put that on the record. I did that with resignations that happened earlier this year. I think it's just good to be transparent about these things and the issues that were raised and make sure people understand why, especially when three people resign in 24 hours. I think it's important for the public to understand why. And they also wanted these things to be shared. Obviously, that is it puts us in a difficult position. And I'd also like to take a second to ask, on IPR's front, what does this mean for our recruitment? Because I know we mentioned that recruitment was halted. So now what?
I don't think we have an answer to that yet. Like you said, two of these, I think we knew Carol was going to leave because she moved to Seattle, but I think the other two came as a surprise. There's obviously a lot of stuff up in the air right now. It's a tough time to ask people to volunteer. We have a meeting next week to try to figure out what our next steps are, but I don't have a great answer for that right now. I think once Shayna Pomerantz is sworn in, we have 7 CRC members, if I'm
correct. That's correct.
Yeah. So
it'd be 8, right? You mean 8 total? Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought it was 7 with Shayna. Maybe it is 8. Yeah. So we'll get all that figured out, and we will, we will let you know as soon as we have more information on it.
Okay. Great. Any CRC members want to comment? Okay. I guess we will go ahead and move on. I mean, I think the letters speak for themselves, and it's disappointing to lose valuable help at this time. And I do hope we can come to a conclusion that recruiting is in our best interest to fill these seats. We're going to have likely many appeals coming down the line after the protests. It just puts a big strain on the rest of the committee when we're not fully staffed. So just adding that for consideration, but Ross and Dana, let's definitely check in next week about it. All right, moving on. So Vadim and I have attended several meetings in the past few weeks, things that we've talked about with you all before. But a new thing is that Sam Diaz, who works in the mayor's office as a policy advisor, has been organizing meetings between all of the council staff and the CRC leadership, PSEP leadership, and TAC. The goal of that is to build a better bridge between all of our organizations and what we do, because many of the things we do overlap, and make sure that all of the staff of the commissioners and the mayor are in the loop. So we had a meeting last week, which was kind of just introductions to everything. And then this, we had a meeting earlier today, and that meeting was to the CRC. We spent time explaining the CRC more in depth and explaining what we've been up to. So that is a relationship that Vadim and I are hoping to continue to foster, as well as with our colleagues on PSEP and TAC. And we will continue to be meeting with the mayor's office as well. We have another meeting that's set up just for those three entities, as well as the mayor's office, PPB, to continue to talk about reform issues. The mayor is trying to keep us in the loop on the 19-point plan that he is pushing. And we're trying to, you know, again, just be in conversation and make sure that our voices from all these committees are being heard along this process. So I will keep you posted. In general, if members want to ask questions or think there are things that you want us to bring to those meetings, Vadim or I, please just let us know. Right now, again, it's kind of, everything's kind of still introductory, still just kind of getting our, you know, our feet wet, but hopefully we'll start having larger discussions on the bigger policy issues. So please let me know. Haven't had any meetings with IPR auditor yet. I do plan to schedule those. And then I think as far as what CRC is working on, I think we should talk about finding time to discuss the things we believe are working in our current system to transfer into a new system if applicable. But also I think it's good for us to do that no matter what, and start identifying the areas that we feel are important to preserve and things that we feel are necessary to change. So that's a larger conversation, but today we'll focus on the appeal. We'll try to get some of that work done in the work groups. Okay, that is my report. Any questions before we move on into the appeal? And I will, this is now when I will close the chat because we're gonna go into the appeal. David, everything good? Also, sorry, just saw this, talk closer to the mic. Can you all hear me okay? I can try to scoot in. You good? Okay. I see there are some questions that are in the chat. I'm going to save those for the end, if that's okay with the committee, so we can move on with the appeals, because we have people here to present on that. Is that okay? I'm not seeing any head nods other than Jihan.
Yes.
Okay. All right. I am closing the chat now, I think. How about David, can you do that? All right. So again, like I mentioned at the beginning, we are not doing the two-step process. There's just one step. We already asked for more information. We received it. Now we are going to go into the appeal. The overview of how this will go, we will, at the end of tonight's appeal, we're going to need to decide whether the Bureau's finding in this case was reasonable and supported by the evidence. As a reminder, as a committee, we are not allowed to substitute our judgment or opinion for the commanding officers. That is due to our reasonable person standard. We've got some newer folks, so I want to make sure everybody understands how to use the reasonable person standard when we make decisions. Even if we personally or as a committee would have reached a different finding, we're not permitted to challenge the RU manager's finding unless we conclude that a reasonable person in their position, taking into account the evidence available to them in the case file, could not have reached the same conclusion. We have three options tonight. We can either affirm the finding, meaning the committee believes that a reasonable person could have made the same decision based on that information. We can challenge the finding, meaning that the committee believes a reasonable person would have reached a different finding based on the available information. And we can include a debrief in any challenge finding. And then, well, actually, we don't have our third option, which is sending the case back, which we're not doing. Okay, so as a reminder, this case has one allegation. The allegation is an unknown officer used excessive force when taking Mr. Davis into custody. So that is under the directive 1010.00, use of force, and the proposed finding was unfounded. David, can you also, perfect. That's what I was gonna ask you, the case file summary. There it is in the chat for the folks in the audience to follow along and also for CRC members. Okay. So we are going to start with the summary of the investigation presented by APR. Then we'll have, this is the, we do not have an appellant. Do we have an APA?
Negative.
Okay. So we have no appellant statement whatsoever. I thought that we were trying to get a written.
Yes. I send the complainant a letter explaining to him that we cannot bring him to the meeting via phone. So he is allowed to write a written statement, but I have not received any statement from him.
Okay, that's a shame. So we will then also hear from Internal Affairs about the finding. We will discuss it. We'll take public comment related to the case. After public comment, we'll hear any rebuttals from the appellant, which is not here, and IA. And then we'll move into a vote. And reminder that everyone must explain your vote. And at the end, we can discuss any policy training or investigation issues that came up in the case that we feel we need to address further. So, has any CRC member present not reviewed the completed case? Okay, so that I am assuming everyone has, and therefore you can participate. If you have not, now's the time to say you can't participate. So let's go ahead and move into IPR summary of the investigation.
I guess I'll turn on my camera. Good evening, everybody. And my plan for this hearing was to just kind of summarize what we received as a subsequent investigation to the initial investigation, since we already covered that in the January hearing. This case was sent back to Internal Affairs, and per the memo that they received from CRC, they requested additional records from OHSU, which were received and placed into the case file. The investigator also did an additional interview with the complainant. The complainant's testimony in that subsequent interview was exactly parallel to the first interview that you guys reviewed in January. And so the complainant states that they, during the arrest, their shoulder was injured. And in the additional medical reports, there was, well, at the first hearing, we already had the medical documentation from the CERT medics, from AMR, from GL intake, and all of those things that kind of documented the injury or lack of injury at that time when the complainant was taken into custody. And the OHSU records indicate that the complainant sought treatment for an injury, I believe, in April of 2018, which would have been some months after they were taken into custody and after the arrest. So, but again, all of that information is in the case file for you all to review. So if you have questions that I can clarify, I'm happy to do that.
I have a question, just in general, because it's an unidentified officer. I mean, what happens in that case? I mean, even if we were to challenge it, for example, like, yeah, what happens?
So we are required to make findings even if the officer is unidentified in a case. And as you may recall, in this case, we were not able to identify which officer may have actually been the one to put cuffs on the complainant. And again, the number of interviews that were completed in trying to identify the information, I think, was exhaustive. And also the idea that there was quite a bit of time that elapsed between the arrest in 2016 and this investigation beginning also clouds and muddies the water somewhat with regard to, okay, who was the person who actually put the cuffs on? And so, so yes, we are at the place of having an unidentified officer. We are required to make findings against an unidentified officer, but then what happens to that person? I mean, we would make findings and then a recommended sanction. I can't remember, that's not the right word, but a recommended discipline for those findings, and that would be your course of action.
Thank you. Sylvan, did you want to ask something?
Yeah, and I guess I don't know if this is the right time for these questions or if you know, exactly to whom they're best directed. But I tried to do a very thorough review and like chart out a timeline, both of the events right after the arrest and the intake, and then also just the, you know, medical treatment that was sought and received. You know, this is my, you know, very small, very detailed writing. It was complicated. There was a lot to look through, and there were a few things that I still thought were conspicuously missing, and I'm not sure if they just don't exist. Or so one is an x-ray that was referenced from 2017, and I'm not certain where that would have been done, but it is referenced in a couple of appellant's later medical records, you know, from later visits. It looks like, sorry, I have to find it in my own small notes. It looks like on June 24th, 2018, appellant had a visit with the community health nurse, and in the notes from that visit, the x-ray from April 26th, 2017 is documented, but not, you know, not the results of the x-ray itself. It's just mentioned. And I think it was in at least one other subsequent record as well. And appellant had mentioned that in his interview, also saying, you know, was x-rayed about 9 months after the arrest and possible injury. And the appellant said in his interview that at that time, whoever had reviewed the x-ray told him that there was probably nothing wrong with the shoulder, but that's not what the medical records that mention the x-ray say. That record from the community health nurse visit in 2018 actually says that the 2017 imaging had showed spurring, possibly consistent with osteoarthritis, and also noted that appellant had sustained a traumatic injury during the 2016 arrest. So now I'm not certain, you know, the way the medical records are documented, that might have just kind of been, you know, reporting what appellant said and not necessarily, you know, the note taker's assessment that that is what happened. But I feel like it's troubling that we don't have that x-ray to refer to, since it was closer in time to the incident. And also later on, I think the fact that appellant had maybe been involved in several altercations while incarcerated was brought up as a possible, you know, that any records that might show an injury from after those, you know, that we can't be completely positive that those wouldn't have contributed in some way. But the 2017 x-ray was before any of those altercations happened. So I feel like it would be extremely valuable to have that x-ray, and I don't know why we don't have it. Two other things in the same vein, his medical records note a 2016 visit with an orthopedic PAC or PAC. I'm not sure, you know, if we say the acronym like that. That was on April 10th, 2018 in the jail clinic. A note is made that appellant was seen by an orthopedic PAC in 2016 and told that his symptoms were secondary to arthritic changes and that the patient was insisting that they were actually from the arrest. And so I don't know what the date of that visit was or why we don't have records of that. And I don't know why we don't have more documentation from the jail intake. I know that we have some things. We had a couple of things that noted that he was diabetic and was being referred to an immediate medical evaluation because of that. It looked like that was in, I guess we're not supposed to use names, you know, officer, whoever, A, B, you know, I don't know. There were so many involved. Page 61 of tab 5, it was noted that appellant had notified, or that medical had been notified that appellant did need an immediate medical evaluation. And from later timestamps, I gathered that was like at 5:23 in the morning of the time that he was taken in and being processed. But we don't actually have any records or reports of what happened in that evaluation. We've got some officers in their interviews saying that he wouldn't have been accepted into jail if he had been found to have an injury, that, you know, a jail nurse should have looked at him and then cleared him, or else said, no, we won't take you, and sent him, you know, basically to, by ambulance, to be evaluated at a hospital and treated at a hospital. And I didn't see any records of the results of that evaluation. And I did notice in the file activity log, which is page 57 of tab 5, from 5:23, when that note was made that medical was notified, until 7:47 in the morning, there were updates about every 20 minutes on like different phases of the intake process, different, you know, phases of being cleared. And then there's a gap of over 3 hours. At 11:05, it says he's cleared by medical to move. So I'm thinking that must have been when he was examined or evaluated. And that just seems to be missing. It seems to be a gap. You know, I wish we knew what happened there, because appellant's story conflicts so much with what the officers who were interviewed have to say. You know, appellant says, I was badly injured, I was screaming, I was in obvious pain, and they put me in a sling and housed me in the medical unit for 3 days. And that's not what any of the interviewed officers say. And so I just really wish that we had some of this documentation that seems to be missing. You know, the earlier x-ray, whatever the 2016 visit with an orthopedic pack was, and also the you know, records of whatever evaluation was done by the jail intake nurse. And I don't understand why we don't have them. You know, we already sent this back for additional investigation one time, and I understand that we can't do it a second time, but I'm feeling very frustrated and conflicted about how to assess this case with what feels like very key information missing. So I'm sorry that was so long, but that's all that I have to say about that.
Thank you, Sylvan. I have the same questions, so thank you for delineating all of that. Julie?
No, I'm just appreciative of the question and had some of the same concerns myself.
Yeah, I wanted to echo that.
I was expecting to see the x-ray. I'm like, I'm not qualified to read the x-ray, but where is it? And then I never saw it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where the x-ray is. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not a doctor, not expert at tracking down medical records. And so I understand that it would make this much easier to evaluate and be able to kind of pinpoint, here's the finding that we should make if we had all of the information. And I don't know, you know, I can't fill in that blank for you. And all I know to tell you is that you have the very challenging job of having to evaluate the case given the missing information and coming to a conclusion, you know, about whether it's that conclusion is reasonable, even with the missing information. I mean, like if we had the x-ray, that would maybe be able to tell you, yes, it's reasonable, no, it's not reasonable. But I think that information is missing and that's been the case all along. And I don't know that's ever been available to anyone who's had to evaluate this, you know, along the path of this case. Am I saying that in a way that makes sense?
And yeah.
I know it'd be wonderful and lovely to have that information, but it's just, I don't know that it's available. Mm-hmm. Anyone know where it is or where it came from. And in doing the records requests, it never showed up.
Well, that makes me feel like the evidence is insufficient. Like, I mean, we don't have sufficient evidence because we don't have the evidence. We don't have the evidence to look at.
And I was going to raise a procedural question because when I was reading, because the appeal is assessing, this is a total new question, but the appeal is assessing the investigator's finding, which was that the claim is unfounded. So if we challenge it, do we have to supplant we have to challenge it suggesting there should be another finding, and do we have to specify what finding we think it should be, or do we just say generally we challenge that it's unfounded?
We have to say what we think it should be.
Okay.
Sorry, Taylor, finish, and then I'll
say no, I mean, I was just going to talk about what I thought about it, because when I was reading it, I really appreciated Sylvan's super thorough timeline. I was trying hard to track it, but from what struck me going through, and I was reading a lot of the officer transcripts and trying to understand because I personally read a lot of police reports, and I was looking through the after action reports and looking at the police reports, trying to see the part of the report where the police officer says, I like handcuff them and double check for fitness. And I read that phrase all the time, and I didn't see any of the reports specify when the person was arrested, and all 17 officers not saying who did the arrest, and no one remembering. And I can understand, like, I could see how a reasonable person could evaluate that record and say, you know, this is so routine, maybe they didn't remember it. But my problem with that is that I don't think that gets you to unfounded, because you're making a credibility assessment about apparently the only person who remembers being arrested and remembers the details of being arrested. And that his statements aren't controverted by, I mean, there are maybe some controverted parts regarding whether or not he was like screaming in the car, but I struggled with the fact that like, there was one report where, I mean, I was trying to figure out the arrest timeline, trying to figure out who took custody of him. And I think it was Sergeant, I can't say his name, their name, Sergeant so-and-so's after action report indicating that after the incident, the complainant here came out laid on the ground. And I think what I was reading from the complainant is that he also recalls being on the ground and then being in a posture where he was being pulled up and then pushed down during the arrest. And there's no other officers discussing any of the process of how they took him into custody and whether that specific act took place. And since we're the question is about the policy of whether there was an excessive use of force, I don't see, I guess the bottom line is, I don't see how you get to an unfounded finding or a credibility finding when for sure one of these officers arrested him. It has to be, unless there's an unknown officer that wasn't listed in any of these reports, but that doesn't, I don't think that supports that you get to unfounded and you make a credibility determination about the guy's complaint when his essential complaint is uncontroverted. No one can describe what happened during the arrest. And so for me, when I was reading it, I was thinking, I don't think a reasonable person could come to this conclusion because they don't have the supporting evidence. It seems like it should have been a not sustained. So that's kind of my thoughts on it.
Go ahead, Ross. Before you go, Ross, let me just say one quick thing that as far as like our process too, we're just at the very beginning, we do still have, we'll hear from command staff, internal affairs, et cetera, so let me know if we want to move to that part, because some of these, I feel these questions were, everybody's going to need to answer them, and I don't know if we want to hear from them and then continue the conversation, so I'm just throwing that out there. But Ross, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar. I think that there's a couple of questions coming up, and, you know, I think when this was sent back for further investigation back in January, I believe the internal affairs investigator looked into the medical records, and I think we haven't heard from IA yet. So maybe Captain Bacigalupi will be able to give more information about, you know, did they do an exhaustive search, what they were able to find. So I think that's one, that's kind of a separate question. I would just say, not to tell you what to do, but it's easy to get off the rails if you don't take one question at a time here.
Yeah, I think we should move through so that we can hear from everybody, and then we'll continue this conversation. Sound good? So per my procedure, next would have been appellant statement, but we do not have one. Following that, we would have had an officer statement. I'm assuming we don't have any of that, correct?
No? Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then now internal affairs overview of the investigation. Not sure who here is presenting on that.
Hey, good evening. Cliff Bacigalupi here.
Hello.
So I'm not going to go into an exhaustive recount of the investigation. We're all aware of the initial investigation. And then Dana, of course, outlined the additional steps taken during the investigation. And I can't, as far as the medical records go, I can't speak directly to what I do know is that they submit a request. On January 20th, this was assigned to Investigator Rick Smith. And He was able to get Mr. Davis to sign a release for those medical records. And then those medical records were requested, and we received whatever OHSU sent to us. And I'm not aware, I don't completely understand the HIPAA laws, although I know there's lots of caveats to it. And I don't know whether they would release an X-ray or not necessarily to people who aren't trained to read those. So that would be a question I would have. Beyond that, I'll let Commander Nakamura talk to the specifics of it. But we took the additional steps that Dana recounted and interviewed Mr. Davis at length. And I'm sure everybody's read the transcripts and or listened to the recordings of that interview. And then obviously that went back out for findings. And so I will let Commander Nakamura talk to the details of the case.
Can I just make a point of order before we hear from Nakamura? If we could just all remember to refer to the person as the appellant rather than using his name, that would be helpful. Okay.
Yes.
My apologies, been a long day.
No worries. Okay. Sorry, I forgot your rank, Nakamura.
Yeah, Art is fine. So I'm just going to read the... So after each incident, this one was a cert call out due to the dangerous situation, the home invasion robberies, the carjacking, and the barricade. So I'll read the sergeant. After every incident, the cert team does a debrief. Where whenever force is used, the sergeant responsible for the after action, and he debriefs each officer. So as part of his after action, and I'll read it, I'll leave the names out. At the direction of the sergeant, the officer is introduced CS tear gas into the shed via 40 millimeter gas rounds. Officer used 11 of the rounds, which only 7 effectively made them into the shed. Additionally, Officer X used 4 40 millimeter sponge rounds to open a vent in which the officer was able to introduce CS tear gas. Once the suspect was affected by the tear gas, he surrendered, walked out of the shed, and laid on the ground. The subject was taken into custody without incident or use of force. Once in custody, Portland Fire Bureau medic was on scene the entire incident, examined the suspect for injury, finding none. The suspect was placed into a patrol car and invoked his rights. A second sergeant who also wrote an after action also indicated suspect had no injuries. And also AMR was on the scene, also documented he had no injuries. And also the jail documented no injuries. So even though since this event, we made it a point for the handcuffing person, the handcuffing officer to write a report, and that person is identified immediately since this event, which should happen at the first point. But we fixed this. I realized that, again, since there's no use of force during the handcuffing, it for them was a no deal, so they didn't write a report. But even though there's no use of force when the handcuffing, now we identify the handcuffing officer. So we documented all the force used, and again in the after action report where we debrief each officer, they all related that again he laid on the ground and taken into custody without incident or use of force.
And is tear gas being deployed to help them get out of the space they were, is that not part of use of force under the arrest, just in general?
Yeah, so that was documented in the after action report.
Right.
So what happened was
considered part of the arrest technically, because, or no?
Yes, so the tear gas was used to force, he would barricade himself and armed with a firearm in the shed, refuse all the commands to come out. So we introduced tear gas into the shed to basically to deny him the area of being in the shed, to force him out. Once he comes out, we give him orders to come out, lay on the ground, which he did, and then subsequently handcuffed and arrested without incident or use of force.
Okay.
And again, since we use gas and since the CERT, so it's kind of stepping back on the CERT team, we have always have at least one medic always on scene because of the high likelihood of serious injury. So again, this fire medic was with us the entire time. And he, once we place him in custody, he immediately tends to him because of the exposure to CS gas. And the fire medic did a complete evaluation. Also, he wrote a report along with the AMR and the jail after that.
Also, I noticed that it mentioned in one of the interviews that the appellant seemed very high. I think they said like they were, there was the highest person they'd ever seen or something. And then when I went, when I saw that, and then I tried to correspond that with like the intake, I didn't see anything that mentioned that he was really high. I was just curious what that, what's that discrepancy? And also when he did get that initial check, which, you know, he had mentioned that he was diabetic. I'm wondering, would that have been documented by the medic that they were also really, you know, under the influence of something? Because that was a very specific thing that I noticed they mentioned when, and I guess the person noticed this when they were in the back of the car, arrested at this point. And I also recalled seeing something from the medic's perspective that the appellant didn't want to cooperate or something. And I need to look at my notes for the rest of how, the rest of that thought. But I'm curious about what are the requirements for documenting that and why did I not see that? That seemed like a very specific thing to mention.
It only helps, one, if we're placing a person in who's in danger of care or custody for themselves, if they're overly intoxicated and can't care for themselves. Let me look, I believe, or sometimes it's used to show a state of mind to commit crimes and why they didn't, what's that word, cooperate with the police. If you're so intoxicated or under influence, a lot of times you're delusional and in an altered state of mind. So that could have been it. But as far as for medical reasons, if you're not actively overdosing, again, I'm not a medic, so I don't know when they'll put it in there. When we put it in there, it's usually if we're taking a person into custody and that's an element of the crime, or trying to explain why there was some behavior that's not normal. And obviously, barricading yourself in somebody else's house is not normal behavior. But let me look for that report. And I believe it was the detective who was actually in charge of the investigation. So he might have been putting note to that to further investigation of why these crimes were committed. But let me look that report up and I'll get right back to you.
Yeah, I'm trying to get some notes and see where that was. Yep. So I have page 58 of tab 2.
Yep, I got it. Detective William Winters. So he is the detective who's gonna investigate the criminal aspect of it. So part of that, to show why these crimes are committed and why the state of mind, part of the, when you're a detective, you always want to kind of put what that person's state of mind was at the time. And obviously, as a detective, that would be important to the actual crime itself. Because normally a person wouldn't do these type of crimes or barricade themselves and not follow police commands.
I guess I don't understand what you mean. What do you mean normally a person in this, I mean, they were running from?
Yes, so this person committed a carjacking and I believe a home invasion robbery. And at this point in time, they broke into people's houses that were sleeping, broke into their house, they're chased out, ran into their shed, barricading themselves in a shed, armed with a handgun, knowing that's not your house, and you just committed some very serious crimes, carjacking, home invasion, robbery. That, for us, that's very high crimes. And you're and knowing the cops are pursuing you, you break into somebody's house, barricade yourself, now in their backyard, in their shed, and not listening to commands from the police. That is, we hardly ever see that, and that's why we very rarely deploy the CERT team. Most of the time, the vast majority of times when we intervene, people comply. Like this one is, it was elevated so high, the actual SWAT team had to come out with special tools and weapons and negotiators to deal with this, which is very, very few and far between.
CRC members, are there questions that are coming up? I know we like took a moment from our previous questions to hear from all, from everybody. I think we've heard from everyone. I know I have on my process here. You know, there's the internal affairs overview, there's the command staff's explanation of the finding, and then IPR's opportunity to comment. I don't know if we kind of blended some of those two, or are there more things to add? So, I guess, and does IPR have anything to comment?
I don't.
Okay. Okay, CRC members.
Well, I think I was trying to say, and not a lot of words, but Taylor said so well, which is, I feel like that there's not the evidence that and the evidence is insufficient. And so I was wondering also why it wouldn't have been a non-sustained finding.
I have that same question too, if someone can answer that.
Since they're Commander Nakamura's findings, we'll let him answer that.
Sorry, I got a bad connection. That was digital. I didn't catch the last 30 seconds. Could you repeat?
Oh, we were just wondering the rationale for the unfounded finding versus the not sustained.
Based off of all the evidence, the police reports, the multiple police reports, independent fire bureau medic, a MR medics, the jail, the complaint not coming in until 2 years later. Again, on scene, if there was a use of force during their handcuffing, it would have been documented by the officers and the sergeant. Again, we already documented all the use of force, including the gas, which is a lot higher level than resisted handcuffing. So that would have been clearly documented. Again, just the reasonable of this, you have 17 professionals who all said they did not use force, two separate supervisors on scene who witnessed the entire event, who said no force was used other than the CS gas. You have other medical professionals on scene that did not see any injuries, nor were any injuries complained of to the medical staff, three different medical staff. So it's, to me, it falls under the unfounded. And with the follow-up interviews and the additional information from the follow-up, it just solidifies the unfounded.
How does the additional information solidify the unfounded finding? Because I believe that the additional information was an interview with appellant and appellant's medical records. So I feel like, I mean, just from my perspective, if anything, that would have called the unfounded finding further into question rather than solidifying it. So I'm a little curious why you would say that.
Again, it provided no new information. Again, and there was no new reports that came out from the jail or from any other medical records that showed that this injury occurred during that time period. Again, it was reported in Mr. Davis, between 2016 and 18, saw no less than 10 doctors. So it's it just verifies everything which was done in the initial investigation. Again, so they looked at additional medical records. Nothing new was located. The statement was exactly the same. There's no new information. And the statement about the jail nurse, the doctor putting his arm in a sling and housing the medical unit, there's no corroboration of that. And again, I've personally been down to jail a number of times, and if the person has any type of physical injury, it's documented and they're denied in minutes and will have to be cleared by a medical facility. So if at that time there was a injury, the officers would have been notified to take him to a medical facility immediately.
I have a follow-up question on that, if I can. So on tab 5, page 51, we've got a Multnomah County Sheriff's Office classification summary report. And for the date of the incarceration, it says that the appellant should start in dorm 15 before going to an open dorm. Could you confirm or clarify whether dorm 15 would be a medical unit or whether it would just be a sort of general dorm for people who do not require medical attention?
I do not work in the jail, so I do not know how they number their dormitories or their jail cells.
So what's the deal with the sling? I guess I don't know where that fits into the larger picture, because it sounds like he was put in a sling. So that to me would directly correlate with shoulder injury, but I guess I don't see where that fits into this larger picture. And the reason also that the officer that mentioned that he was buried, the highest person he'd ever seen, that stuck out to me because I wonder, like, does that affect someone's ability to be able to feel a pain? I mean, I'm not a doctor, but that just stuck out to me as an important detail. So I found it weird when I couldn't correlate that statement with anything else because you just said it so definitively. So, but what's up with the sling situation?
Because I just have in the report, where'd it go? In one of the reports, I'm trying to dig it up right now. Stated when he got to the jail, a jail nurse or doctor put his arm in a sling and housed him in the medical unit.
That's when he got to the jail after the arrest. Right.
I don't have a time frame for that. Just when he got to the jail. Could have been the jail the first time or after seeing a doctor the third or fourth time. Could have been in 2018 where he was finally diagnosed with the shoulder injury. I am not sure.
In my notes, I have you're looking at appellant's interview, correct? Like the interview transcript?
I seen that earlier. Now I am reading the follow-up report by the investigator in January of 2020.
Oh, okay. Well, I have noted that in the appellant's interview, he had said at booking, he complained about the shoulder, was put in a sling and housed in the medical unit. He said the jail nurse put the sling on him. He saw a doctor 3 days later and was released from the medical unit. I think that's, you know, I don't think there's necessarily any ambiguity in the record about when appellant claims the sling was put on. I think the claim is pretty clear that it was at booking for the arrest.
Are there any medical records of the sling being put on? Is that what we're getting at here? Is that he says that there's a sling, but there's no medical records showing that there was?
That is one of the pieces of information that I was dismayed was missing. Was just, you know, any record from whatever evaluation would have been done by medical at the jail. I know that we have, you know, on the jail intake form, it says he's diabetic, and then a second intake form, you know, it's something is circled and it says, you know, he does need immediate medical evaluation. And then several hours later, he's cleared by medical as reflected in the file activity log. So I think what is missing from my perspective that would be very useful is any documentation of what the medical evaluation upon intake at the jail showed. And I guess maybe it would be useful if I ask a direct question. I know you said you don't work at a jail, so you might not be as familiar with the procedures here, but Commander Nakamura, could you tell me if you know, like, would that be something that there would typically be a record of? Like, if someone is evaluated medically upon intake at a jail, you know, it seems to me like it would be very likely that that would be documented in some kind of record, but do you know if it is not routinely documented?
So if there was an injury, it's down to like an abrasion. The jail notifies us and that we would need to have this person cleared by medical before we admit that person to the jail. So if there's any injuries on anybody going to jail, they will not admit that person unless cleared by medical.
Well, I've heard that, but
so we would have to, they would call us back and document, they called us back and we would have to take that person.
So I guess maybe I should phrase it more specifically. Because in the record, it does say in the file activity log, page 57 of tab 5, that at 11:05 in the morning, he was cleared by medical to move. So that implies to me that there was an evaluation done. Otherwise, I don't know what cleared by medical means in that context. And on the intake form, it was said that he would need an immediate medical evaluation. So if we've got those two things bookending it, that to me says there was a medical evaluation. I'm wondering why there's not a record of that. And so I guess my question for you was, if a medical evaluation happens, you know, whether they find an injury or not, just when the evaluation is done, you know, is there a record of that? Would the jail nurse or whoever does the medical evaluation directly and then ends up clearing the person to, you know, do the rest of the intake? Is there a record made?
You hit the nail on the head where we don't know, and I don't know either. But again, I know for a fact that if a person is diabetic or possibly going to diabetic shock and not showing symptoms, they put them in a separate cell for evaluation. So again, we don't know. We can guess maybe it was for the shoulder injury or it could have been for his diabetic state where they have them evaluated because it says diabetic and that gets flagged by the jail staff if you're going if you're diabetic or not, to know that you may need insulin. So it could have been for that. Again, I'm not sure why they had him in the medical ward or cell or whatnot. So that is a great question. But again, if they're injuries, they will deny admittance and tell us to pick our detainee back up. And that did not happen. And I'm looking on the intake sheet as we speak. And again, it says notified medical and only other injury or condition I see on there is diabetic.
When you say no injuries, I mean, if he just had abrasions, they wouldn't ask you to pick him back up, but that's like a minor injury, right? So is there a spectrum of injuries?
I have personally been called back for abrasions.
Okay.
But then it's the jail policy. And again, abrasions, they will call us.
And where do you take them again?
We would have to take them. And when I was a street officer, using the Portland Adventist, or sometimes we have Portland Adventist, or sometimes we have the fire medics meet us out front. It kind of depends the severity of the injury. But again, the jail does not accept folks with injuries unless cleared.
So I was actually looking at the second intake form. You had just referenced to the one where it's noted that he's diabetic, and that's the only note in that field. That's on page 60 of tab 5. The next page, which it looks like it's not signed, but noted with the name of a corrections deputy, as opposed to the person who's listed as the transporting officer on the previous page. The question, have you been in the hospital or treated by paramedics / fire in the last 24 hours, is circled yes, seen by paramedics. And then also, is there a need for an immediate evaluation of this arrestee by medical staff or a custody supervisor? That's also circled yes, and there's a note, notified medical. So that's what I was referring to as, you know, strongly seeming to indicate that there was a medical evaluation. So I feel like we're kind of going in circles with how we're asking and answering these things, but it seems like I understand that you're saying that, you know, depending on the results of a medical evaluation, that officers would be called back and the person would not be cleared and all that. But I feel like on the one hand, the record of the evaluation is missing, assuming that they make a record, you know, whatever the result of the evaluation is, but also something that I want to, you know, I'm not saying that this happened in this case, because certainly we don't have the evidence to conclude this, but hypothetically there could be a case where the core of the problem is that policy wasn't followed. So I don't see how, you know, saying that this is the standard policy, I'm familiar with this being the policy, therefore we can conclude that this is what happened. I don't think that that's evidence either, that something happened a certain way, because, you know, if something makes it into the complaint process and all the way to an appeal, I just don't think you can conclude that policy was definitely followed in the absence of evidence that policy was followed. I feel like that's extremely problematic, given that if someone's complaining, you know, possibly it's because they feel that some policy was violated. And I just wanted to state that, because that's something that really bothered me while I was reading the interview transcripts as well. You know, multiple of the officers said, well, we don't remember, but we can tell you that this, you know, didn't happen the way that appellant says, because that's not what the policy is. And I found that maddening to read. So I would like to put that on the record. And I would also invite responses to that, but I realized that wasn't a direct question. So don't.
Yes, I agree with you 100% on the medical records from the jail. If they're a lot better written and a lot more clear, we wouldn't have any of these issues. And again, I just go what's written on reports. And I am under the fact that the vast majority, if not, I'll say almost every officer follows policy. I assume when I read reports, people are following policy. And I don't know this sheriff's deputy who did the intake, and I'm gonna give him the credit that he is following policy, and that the officers and sergeants were following policy. And again, I agree with you 100% that the issue is the jail records, and that could, if they clearly listed, you know, if they did a full body exam like the fire medic did, it would have been a lot cleaner. Again, the fire medic did a complete body exam, didn't find any injuries. That was done a third time by the sheriff's office when they highlighted notified medical and why they're notified medical. That would probably clear us a lot better for all of us.
I just heard you say a couple times that they followed policy, but what is the evidence? I don't know where that's coming from.
The officer, if they did use force or handcuffed them using force, they would have wrote a report, and that's our policy. So just reading all the after actions, I'm saying that the officers were in policy. And if they did use force during the handcuffing, they would have wrote a report documenting the use of force, and the sergeants would have completed the after-action review of that use of force.
But that's not evidence that they did follow the policy. That's just an assumption that the policy was followed as you're reading through the after-action reports.
Yeah, that's very troubling. I'm trying not to have a strong reaction, but I'm having a strong reaction to that.
I'm kind of understanding exactly what the strong reaction is. So in order to follow policy for not use of force, there would be no report if there was no use of force. If we take for granted right now, if we take 17 officers and some supervisors testimony that there was no use of force, then there would be no nothing filled out. And how would you prove that there was no use of force at this point? That there was, why would it be troubling if there was no use of force? Let me restate that. You're saying it's troubling because there was nothing filled out, assuming that there was use of force. But if there was no use of force, then they were following policy, correct?
Yes. Or sorry, that was to Candace, not to me, I guess.
Is that to me? Let's
assume there was no use of force. Would the result be that policy was followed? Because there was no after action.
There was use of force, say the last part again.
If there was no use of force, would you say that policy was followed here?
I don't know.
Let me say that. What's troubling, I guess? I'm trying to understand what in this timeline is troubling about the use of force, or what was filled out and what was not filled out.
I think it was the reasoning that was offered seems right. Troubling.
The reasoning is what's troubling.
Yes, that's what I was responding to also. I think Vadim is pointing something out that's good to consider about what makes, you know, the evidence situation here tricky, which is that if there had been no use of force, then there would have been no use of force to document, therefore no use of force would have been documented. And so that's, you know, where we're looking at negatives and you know, looking for positives, and it's very, you know, it's, I understand your point, Vadim. And I was troubled more by the reasoning that the commander offered just now as well. It seems like irrespective of what is in the record in this particular case, the notion which I did sort of see playing out in some of the officer interviews in this case. The reasoning that we're inferring that there was no violation of policy simply because policy dictates that something should happen a certain way. It's circular.
And I think that's just confusing me. It's circular. You kind of have to assume that there was force for policy not to be followed, but I don't know how to make that jump based on what we have here. Let me throw up a document here. Tab 3, page 20. It's the pre-hospital care report, and I'll read the narrative here. Subject in police custody after being forced out of a tool shed by CS gas. Patient being a type 1 diabetic and states that he has not sure if he has his CBG is high. States that he doesn't take insulin. I'm going to fast forward here a little bit. Said that he has not eaten since lunch. Patient willfully refuses to answer pertinent questions and initially fakes unconsciousness. Exam, head, no obvious trauma, refuses to open his eyes for assessment. Neck, no JVD, trach, midline, CX equal, expand with good, title, that's lungs. Volumes, clear bilaterally in all fields. Soft, non-tender, that's, I think, stomach area. Pelvis, intact and stable. Arms, legs, POSIM, PSM times 4 with equal strong. So POS, PSM, I think is movement. So times 4, that's all 4 limbs with equal strong grips. Impression, physically fit, no medical issues discovered. Is that the pre-hospital report that you all were kind of referring to earlier, or is there a different one?
That's not the one that I was referring to. I read over that one, and without discounting the value of that one on the scene, the one that I feel like I would like to see is whatever report would have been made by the person evaluating him upon intake at the jail, since that seems to be kind of the commander here and several of the officers in their interviews said that they could infer that there was no injury to appellant, because if there had been an injury, jail wouldn't have accepted him upon a medical evaluation. And so just not having that report of whatever evaluation was done on the site at jail before he was cleared by medical at 11:05 in the morning after his arrest, that's what I've been referring to as what's the report that's missing.
I just have one question. Do we give any credit to the fire bureau medic was on scene who gave him the full body examination at that time of the arrest? or is that kind of just, it's something to look at, but we don't really
I think that's what I'm
take it as an actual medical record.
Yeah, that's what I'm pointing to. Do we give credit to at least?
I'm not dismissing that one when I do my evaluation. It's just that I would really like to have as many reports as possible from as many different examiners as possible, so that we could, you know, like if there was an evaluation from whoever medically checked out appellant at the jail, and it, you know, corroborated the first evaluation that we've been looking at from, you know, on the scene of the arrest, that would be evidence. If it didn't corroborate it, that would be a different kind of evidence. And I'm not discounting what we do have, what you just read from Vadim. It's I would just like a more complete picture. And I think as Candace pointed out, it seemed maybe possible that if appellant was noted to be extremely high at the time of arrest, that could have potentially affected how he was communicating or presenting in such a way as to influence the on-scene evaluation. I'm not certain of that. It seems like there are enough factors here that I would like to have a better sense over time in terms of hours as well as months, you know, with the missing x-ray from 2017 of just anything that could have been documented at any stage. I would be, you know, really hoping to see if that makes sense. I hope that answers the questions.
Yeah, and I've just been sitting here marinating on unfounded versus not sustained. I mean, per the definitions of all of these, unfounded is the allegation was false or devoid of fact, or there was not a credible basis for a possible violation of policy or procedure. Whereas not sustained is the evidence was insufficient to prove a violation of policy or procedure. Like, I don't know how people feel about those two changes, like those two differences. I know we brought that up a little earlier, but I think what I'm hearing in the discussion is feeling like there's not a completeness of the picture, and it, you know, unfortunately it doesn't look like we're going to be able to get that, but does that mean that it would be more not sustained, or I don't know, how are people interpreting that?
Yeah, I mean, I land on the not sustained. I think I kind of described why earlier in the meeting, but I don't know. I mean, I keep trying to think of a good way to analogize it, and I just think of, like, we're trying to determine whether or not there's a violation of policy, right? A use of force, an excessive use of force. And one of the ways I think the discussion is very heavily weighted, and it makes sense, is trying to find an injury as proof or non-proof of whether or not there was, like, a use of force. But I don't know, it's like looking at the ground and to see if it's wet to indicate whether it's rained. But for me, there's no evidence that it rained because there's no description of the rain happening. Like, there's no officers saying that they recall arresting this guy. And I mean, if you just have 17 officers and not one of them is saying that they were the ones to put cuffs on him or the ones to do the arrest, I just don't know that there's a reasonable person could arrive at the basis that there was no excessive use of force, because no one's described anything happening there. We kind of have like a blank, and that's why I'm at not sustained, because we don't know who arrested the guy. We don't have a description. And I get that, like, it makes sense. Like, I can understand, practically speaking, like the idea that if there was a use of force during that, they would write a report, and maybe you can draw from that that there wasn't a use of force. But I mean, just logically speaking, drawing from the assumption that policy is followed, I mean, that could be a safe assumption, but I would sure just like to, I just think it falls in kind of equipoise then, because if you have the appellant saying that all this stuff happened, and I guess it's not even equipoise, if he's saying all of this stuff happened and no one's describing anything except it was a non-event, I just don't see how at the core part of whether or not the question of, like, there was an excessive use of force, if there's no descriptions from the officers about the incident, I just don't think you can say that the guy's statements are unfounded. It seems just like it's not sustained, just like they're, whether you look at the medical evidence or just the descriptions of the event, it just seems like it's insufficient to prove that there was a violation of policy. Not that the guy is I don't know, making it up. That makes sense.
Jihan, did you
want to
add something?
So I feel differently. I feel like we do have the Portland Fire Bureau's report, and we do have the after action report. And because at the time there wasn't this policy that said that the arresting officer should write a report, I understand we're in sort of a gray zone where we would have liked to have more evidence, but it just doesn't exist, or it's not available to us. And it wasn't available to the RU manager either when they made their determination. And our standard of review is, can a reasonable person arrive at this finding given the evidence? I think we're trying to, in a way, sort of shoehorn a use of force case into this because we're taking the appellant's word at face value, which we probably should, but there's nothing corroborating it on the other end. There is no evidence that shows. In fact, there's evidence that shows from the Fire Bureau's report that there may not have been. So I feel differently. I feel like a reasonable person could actually reach this conclusion.
I understand where you're coming from with that, Jihan, but I do want to say that, I mean, if it's a matter of sometimes there's inadequate evidence, but we're all looking at the same evidence, then we could never find something to be not sustained if it were a matter of we all had to consider the same evidence and there's just one body of evidence, and if we can't get access to the other evidence, then we can't make an evaluation based on that, right? I mean, we've made many findings that said that there was not enough evidence to support a claim.
I agree with that, Julie. I just feel like we do have evidence here that supports that that may not have been use of force.
No, I see where you're coming from with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hard case because there's just so many little details, and I appreciate, Sylvan, how you were able to lay it out at the beginning for everybody. I know I definitely grappled with all of the information and trying to piece together the right timeline, and there was just random little parts that stuck out to me that I was like, but that doesn't really add up with the timeline. And so I get also that would be equally hard for the RU manager to sift through because there are gaps in the information. But I still feel like it's not sustained. I don't know. I think it describes the situation better than unfounded, but I mean, I can definitely be swayed. But that's still sticking out to me. I'm trying to continue to wrestle with that.
And this art, and this is my last statement. And what kind of got me there is I have 17 officers, two supervisors who witnessed the custody, and all of them who said the exact same thing. There's no use of force and no arrested without any further incident. Then a fire medic on scene who says there are no injuries. Also their AMR on scene who also did an evaluation. Then jail. So for me, again, I assume that everyone does follow policy, and when they don't, I hold them accountable. But when I have two supervisors and 17 officers stating that they didn't use any force, and it's not like we're covering up the use of force because we've already deployed 40 millimeter rounds, we deployed gas. It's not like it's creating any extra work for us. And again, so there was no reason not to document it if it was done, because we've already done it with the whole incident. So that's where I came from. And then again, the initial complaint coming 2 years later and the whole time frame issue. But again, I respect everybody's decision-making and thought process. And I've learned some little things here and there. So I just want to thank you all, but I'll let you carry on. That's just my two cents, and I'll leave it there.
So there's an old saying, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And in this case, we really seem to have absence of anything corroborating the appellant's story. And we have, as was just stated, a lot of people that have a contrary view of what happened that night. So unless I see something that somehow corroborates an individual's story, the best we have here is an MRI showing osteoarthritis of the shoulder, which is an ongoing thing, and a labrum tear, which was 2 years after the fact and could have happened at any point in time. And certainly this person had back problems, shoulder problems, other problems. But do I have anything in the record where I can link it to something that an officer does? And I don't. And it's hard for me to assume that, because there's no link, that obviously we must be missing something and there must be a link. And so we must draw a conclusion based on that. So that's kind of where I stand, sort of along with lines with what Jihani said, but similar.
But Vadim, I don't think anyone is saying, it is suggesting that the finding would be sustained, which is what you're, it seems like you're sort of saying, like there is no evidence that it happened, right? Like no one's, that's what you're saying, that, but no one's arguing that it did happen, that we know that it happened. Some of us who are kind of on, at least for me, I'm on the fence about whether a reasonable person could come to this conclusion that it's unfounded or not. I'm trying to weigh this in my mind, but there, that's not, no one's arguing that it definitely happened. What we're arguing is maybe there's not enough evidence to say that it was unfounded and that we would lean towards not sustained.
Right, but there's no evidence. And so if there's no evidence, what kind of evidence would there be that something actually did not happen? It's like proof of nothing happening, in a way, is what the standard would be at that point.
No, I don't think that's, that I'm not quite seeing it that way. I mean, I think that we're saying that we're still missing parts of the story. And for that reason, it feels like there's inadequate evidence come to that judgment. I mean, to me, there's founded, right? It, you know, I mean, it, or sustained, it happened, and then there's, you know, exonerated, it didn't, I mean, or unfounded, it didn't happen. But here we're saying we just don't feel like we have the evidence to come to any of those conclusions.
And I'd also like to point out, it's not the case that there's no corroborating evidence. We just don't have a ton of context for what we are looking at sometimes with the medical records. So, obviously I would have liked to have seen the records from the medical evaluation done at the jail. I also would really like to have seen a report on that 2017 x-ray. I would also like to have seen a report on whatever exam appellant had in 2016 with an orthopedic pack. But from my read of the medical records, several of them do reference appellant, having a traumatic shoulder injury from the arrest. And again, I would be open to the interpretation that that's just, you know, doctors kind of scribing in notes just as the appellant is speaking and not necessarily the doctor making a determination that that's what happened. But I think that's an inference. That's like a judgment call or an assumption on its own. So just given that we have, appellant's own account of what happened, and then we've got several medical records. From June 2018, as well as April 2018. It's one more, I think, showing, references to the traumatic injury during the arrest. I feel like, that might not have made it into the medical record if the doctor didn't believe that that happened medically. And I mean, I don't have the medical background to assess, whether we could say for sure that the types of injuries that are shown in appellant's imaging records, whether those are definitely only caused by years and years of osteoarthritis, or if it might have been the case that it was a combination. Perhaps it's osteoarthritis that was aggravated by a traumatic injury, who knows whether that would have been during the arrest or during, you know, one of the fights while he was incarcerated that are documented. But, you know, there is, it's documented that there was imaging done in 2017, and we don't have that, and we don't have a report of that. So I just want to, you know, I wanted to clarify, it's not like I'm so desperate to find corroborating evidence that I'm just making stuff up that's missing. We do know of documents that are missing that could shed some light one way or the other on the state of appellant's shoulder at that time, and perhaps on doctor's comments that may or may not have been included in that report, you know, assessing what could have caused that, you know, like whether it was definitely arthritis, definitely an injury, or a toss-up, you know, who knows, or maybe a combination. Those are things that are out there that we don't have. And I understand that the everyone who, you know, reviewed this case and made their findings also didn't have that. So I understand that our job is to, you know, judge the findings and not whether appellant, you know, has a shoulder injury. But that's just where I'm coming from on the things that I wish I'd seen and why.
I think I think page 25 of tab 5 might have been the first time, or at least it's the first time that I noted it, where a health professional is stating that the patient is insistent that symptoms are from being dragged by his shoulder during arrest. Was there an earlier medical reference to the arrest? When we also have the Portland Fire Bureau's report stating that the person has, you know, use of all four limbs, that there are no injuries there, and that was from the day of the report. Any subsequent medical information, as you stated, could have been from another injury sustained at some other point. There's nothing to corroborate that what happened on that day. The only medical information that we got from the day of the event is from the Fire Bureau. So to me, it would be reasonable to find that that there is no evidence to show that there was use of force in that way.
The other record I was looking at is on page 30 of tab 5, so just a couple of pages down from that. It's not earlier. I think you'd ask specifically if there was any earlier documentation, but it's just a couple of months after what you read from. So it's June 24th, 2018, and the note there says imaging for 2617, which showed osseous spurring, proxima humerus, consistent with osteoarthritis, sustained traumatic injury during 2016 arrest. So that's in the medical record. We don't know what caused the doctor to make that note in that way.
Jihan, based on what you just said, does that bring you to unfounded?
Yes, I think a reasonable person could find it, that it's unfounded.
And I guess just one note, just talking about corroboration, I guess I'll stick on my like narrow scope of just trying to determine what happened at the actual time of arrest. But since none of the officers seem to remember if they were the one to put cuffs on the guy, the only corroboration I think we have about like what sort of physically happened is that two of the younger fellows that were the most likely, I guess, to be the ones that arrested him based on policy. I think one of them described that they would have done the process of having one person on each arm. And the appellant did state it was the guy who was holding his right arm. So there was at least some corroboration that if policy was followed in that respect, there was two people arresting him, and then there was one guy on his right arm at some point. But I mean, I guess just reiterating where I'm at, I think without even having an officer identified as being the person who arrested him, I'd struggle to see how a reasonable person could say it's unfounded. I think if we had an officer saying, I was the one who arrested him, or if there was evidence in the record, a reasonable person could look at an officer saying, you know, I was the one who arrested him, there was no incident. I think it'd be a lot more persuasive for unfounded, but I think without even knowing who we're talking about, it seems like a non-starter to me. So that's kind of where I'm landing with the not sustained.
I have a sort of unrelated question, I guess, which is there was a tort claim. I'm not clear on whether that's still in progress or whether it concluded. I know that there had been, there were notes in the file about the criminal case, I think now concluding, but I don't know what the rules would be on, you know, speaking to appellant's attorney. I know appellant's attorney in the criminal case was contacted and she'd mentioned that she was not the attorney on the tort claim. I just wonder if any additional evidence would have been unearthed in the course of investigating the tort claim and arguing that that might have been useful here, or if any attempts were made to figure out whether the tort claim had turned up anything that would have been relevant here. I don't know. I don't know who can speak to that.
And real quick, a follow-up to you on that, on your question, Sylvan. Is the tort claim related to the $10 million in damages? Is that, like, I had to look up tort claim because I didn't know what that meant. So is that what you're referring to, Sylvan?
Yeah, and I think in a couple places in the file, maybe, I think appellant does note, maybe it's just in his interview, that there's a tort claim. Maybe it wasn't in the interview. It might have just been on the, you know, complaint, papers that were handwritten that he had submitted. I'm not sure exactly.
That's where we got the claim. We got started the investigation based on the appellant filing a tort claim with the city. And so the tort claim was filed and we opened an investigation into whether there was police misconduct associated with the tort claim.
Got it. That's good to know. All right, so we're starting to get quiet. So I don't know where people are. People are feeling like they need more time or apt to ask more questions, or if people are starting to get close to a conclusion. So what's the temp check on that?
I think we could be ready to make a motion.
Let me just make sure my procedure is right. So I guess we're in the discussion / motions phase, yeah. So we could make a motion and then go into public comment, right? So is that what people are feeling, like we're ready to go there? Actually, yeah. We make the motion before the public comment, right, David? Or, because I actually have it after public comment, but I wasn't sure if that was right. This was passed down to me from
Kristen. You can make the motion before public comment and have somebody second it, and then people can, you know, and in the public can comment, yes.
Okay.
Well, I would make a motion to challenge the finding and change to unsustained. Not sustained.
Okay. So we have a motion for challenging it to not sustained. Is there a second for that?
I second.
Okay. So motion and seconded to challenge the finding for not sustained. Do you want to speak to why you are making this motion, Julie?
Well, I feel like Taylor and Sylvan have used a lot more words and spoken very persuasively, but and so I agree with their points. But in general, I feel like this is a situation in which there's, we do have some evidence, we have some stories, but it's not, I think, completely clear what happened that night. And I definitely don't think that there is information to suggest that an act occurred, but I think that there's not enough evidence to suggest that the allegation was false. I feel like there's evidence out there that we haven't had access to, and so I think that what we have in front of us is insufficient to prove that there was a violation. And it was insufficient to say that the appellant wasn't credible.
Taylor, do you want to speak to your second?
Yeah, I agree with Julie, obviously by the second, but I agree with her points. I think there is a ton of questions that a reasonable person could raise about the medical records and the evidence of an injury, but to me that is a question down the road from whether or not there was a use of force. And I just, without any officer saying that they were the person in the situation that could have used force, no one really knows who this person would be. I don't think there's enough to say that his statement's unfounded or that a reasonable person could find that, because we don't know what officers we're talking about. And we don't have a description of the event from anyone except from the appellant. And so I think based on that, I think a reasonable person could not find that it was unfounded. I think a reasonable person ought to have found that it was not sustained.
Anyone else want to add thoughts to this motion?
Can I just make a comment as to what Taylor just said? Yeah. I feel like we do have evidence of what happened that night in the after action report. I think that is where the events as they transpired that night were documented or were supposed to be documented. So I do feel like we have that.
Hi, this is Vadim. I understand where everybody's coming from, and that's why I asked some of the questions I did. I'm trying to better understand what kind of evidence would be needed to fully show unfounded if we don't have enough. And I don't see anything around that time frame collaborating what this individual who broke into someone's house and carjacked and had a gun and all the other things that were happening, corroborating his story. I'm not sure why we're discounting the story of 17, or why the argument is that we should discount the story of 17 police people on the site and two supervisors and the fire department and AMR in order to give the benefit of the doubt. I think I'm a reasonable person, and I can certainly find that things are unfounded. And I don't mean that in jest, but I would think that it's unfounded just because there's nothing I can point to in the record corroborating any of this.
I hear what you're saying, but just to be clear, the motion did not mean that I see anything in the record that corroborates his claim. I was saying that there's a lack of evidence.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of addressing just the general issues. There's a lack of evidence, which is why I think it's unfounded. I don't mean to dismiss anybody's. Don't take it like I'm disagreeing with you wholeheartedly. There could be certainly more things in the record to show that there was no injury to a shoulder. I just don't see around that time frame what there is, and so that's kind of my argument at that point.
Yeah, I gotta admit, I'm feeling very stuck. The this is definitely a tough one. But I think I lean towards agreeing with not sustained as being the right finding for this case. I need to think about it for a couple more minutes. Sylvan, did you want to add anything?
I mean, I'm not sure if I have anything new to say aside from what I've already said. One of the things I'm wrestling with as well, you know, the first time that this came to us, none of us and no one who had made the findings had seen any of the medical records or interviewed the appellant. I know that the appellant had not been interviewed due to his attorney saying not to do it. So I'm not claiming that that was like negligence on the part of the investigators, but just the, you know, we could only send it back once, and then the additional things that we got back are what we got back. But if we feel like that's insufficient, you know, I guess I'm feeling like there's so little recourse that we have to ensure that the process gets all the information out. I don't know. That's kind of it's a little bit of a non sequitur, I guess, when we're talking about, you know, this specific vote, but that was something that I did find frustrating during, you know, the process of looking at this the first time and then, you know, now the second time, just wishing that there was more, you know, like I'm certainly not claiming that this happened this time around, but I could imagine a situation in which some things weren't investigated, you know, maybe even for deliberate reasons. And I'm not saying anything about what happened or didn't happen in this case or anyone who was involved with the investigation and the findings, but I could imagine a situation where some things were left not investigated, you know, maybe even on two rounds of investigation, you know, say that a body like the CRC sends it back one time for further investigation and, you know, new findings. And it's the first time that I've found myself considering whether there aren't enough safeguards on the process to make sure that everything is super thorough in terms of turning up all of the evidence that would be really relevant in the case. I don't know if I have anything to add to clarify that. I hope that made sense.
I think it's interesting that this that we would have different information if the same incident had happened after the changes had been made around documenting the person doing the handcuffing. So it almost seems to me that, like, and this isn't because of any sort of policy it's not being followed, that there's like inherent in the case a lack of evidence because you don't have that documentation and we don't have anybody able to identify the officer, the appellant, or anyone involved. So therefore, like, it seems like on its face, this is a case that has a lack of information that is being put in front of us. Inadequate information to make a finding.
Yeah, and I just want to also specify too, and I talk about like descriptions of the event or descriptions. I'm like thinking very, very narrowly on like specific descriptions of the arresting incident. Since that's in question, it's like the excessive use of force and most of the statements from officers, which I think were just conclusory of non-event or there was no event. It's just a conclusory statement. It's not really like it's not a statement supported by like, it was a non-event because he complied and didn't resist and there was no movements from him. Like, I think the reason why I keep going back to not sustained is there's just no descriptions from the police officers of the arresting incident, and there's no descriptions of which officers did it. So I'm probably sounding like a broken record, but because without those specific descriptions, all we have is the very narrow corroboration between the appellant describing being picked up by both arms or having both of his arms grabbed, and maybe, I mean, slight corroboration, because maybe one of the officers that did it said that would have been the way they did it. And I just think based on that, it's without really specific, like without a description of that event, I just, that's where I get to the, like, it's a, there's just, it should be a not sustained, or that a reasonable person could find that it's unfounded, because there's no one really saying what exactly happened during the arrest, except for the appellant here.
It sounds a lot like the standard review has moved from reasonable, whether a reasonable person could have found the finding, to guilty until proven innocent. If the police don't somehow demonstrate that they did everything right, then they must have done something wrong. In this record, there's nothing to demonstrate that anything was done wrong. Why are we reading into it that there was?
No one is saying that anybody did anything wrong.
Right, but the appellant is clearly saying that there was some, they saw the situation differently, and that's the evidence that we have to analyze. So I don't get where that argument is coming from, Vadim, because I feel like for me, I'm looking at the information and I'm seeing, of course, more people said something than the one person. There's 17 or 20 against one. Obviously, that there's an imbalance there, and that makes it difficult. But I don't think that anyone's saying, like, we're trying to pin it on somebody. It's just that there's not enough information. The appellant not only has a tort claim, not only has some records to show some kind of injuries, but there's not enough records to directly connect it to the incident, and none of the officers remember if they did it. So I don't think that's unfounded. I think that's not sustained, you know?
But there's no records showing that it happened other than the appellant saying that it happened. The examination at the exact same time this happened by the fire bureau did not show that there was anything wrong with the shoulder. They went into detail about the diabetes and the allegations about that, but did not mention anything about the shoulder problem. Why would they go into such detail about diabetes when the person was claiming that he was in severe pain from the shoulder, leading to years of excessive pain? I mean, there's just nothing in the record other than around that time, other than this individual saying that that's what happened. So what more evidence would be necessary to show that nothing happened other than the fact that everybody who was there said that nothing happened?
But
including the fire bureau and the ambulance and the police.
Right, but not everybody that was there said that nothing happened. I mean, that's just not correct. Right.
And if the claimant said nothing happened, if the appellant said nothing happened, then of course he wouldn't have a case. But that's kind of what we're getting at here. Can one person, because they say something happened, create an incident? That's how I view it.
The question is could a reasonable person find that there was that this claim was unfounded? And I am saying, actually, no, a reasonable person should not have made that finding, could not have made that finding. But, and rather, they should have found that there wasn't enough evidence. That doesn't mean that it happened. Otherwise, I would have made a motion to say it was founded. I'm not suggesting that at all.
And so the finding that you think is appropriate is what?
That it's unsustained, that there's insufficient evidence.
But I think we do have evidence that something did not happen in the fire bureau's report, in the after action report, in the testimonies 2 years later by everybody else.
I totally respect the disagreement. I just wanted to clarify what my position was. Totally respect disagreeing with the motion.
Yeah, and I totally respect your opinion as well. I just, I have a different view on it.
can we just go to a vote? And I think it's going to be, what, 3-2 or something?
Well, we still need to hear from the public. So.
Oh, sorry about that.
People haven't voted yet. So I'm still on the fence, honestly. I'm definitely leaning towards not sustain, but it's complicated. I'm trying to wrestle with those two, with unfounded and not sustained. So I need to process it a little more.
What do we do if it's it's 3, it would be 3-3, right? There's 6 of us.
Yeah, what actually does happen if it's a tie? I don't remember, David.
I don't know.
Okay.
We're going to have to look up Robert's rule.
I think the chair
Robert's rule,
it would be five votes, and then the chair is the tiebreaker.
Wait, what?
There's only 5 votes, right? Aren't you, as the chair, the tiebreaker? Like, you don't always get a vote, right?
No, I vote.
Okay. I don't know then.
Yeah, there's 6 votes. And per Robert's rules, if it's a tie, it fails. So, I don't, if we're going strictly on Robert's rules. So, I don't know. Let's cross that bridge when we get there. How about we go into public comment? Yes? Okay. So we're going to move into that. So for the public, hold on, let me open the chat up again. please raise your hand and if you would like to speak. And you can also add things in the chat. Please send them to all panelists and attendees. And we are going to start with Lee or Leah, please.
Hi, this is Leah Peace. I live in Old Town Chinatown, and I'll make it brief. In the absence of evidence, it is unreasonable to assume that 17 people have a better memory than one person when 17 people have access to reports where the one person does not have access to reports. And a comment not particularly relevant to this case, but in general, regarding how the police union works. If the police union were responsible for covering the tort cases financially, I think the truth would come out. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next up, we have Mr. Handelman. I don't know. Were you able to figure out speaking? Okay, comments are in the chat. So comments from Dan Handelman, Portland Cop Watch. 1, agree at worst, this should be not sustained. It is not reasonable to say that without all the possible evidence, including who handcuffed the appellant and how, that you can say unfounded. Okay. Any other comments? Oh, there's more. Okay. Number two. Police Review Board report August 2020 had an officer who failed to file a force report. Okay. Number 3, officers assumed appellant was high but likely was in diabetic issue. I'm assuming that means issue. And when you're done with your comments, say in the chat that you're done, Mr. Hamlin. Number 4, you are allowed to send case back, but PPB doesn't have to investigate. Okay, we can address that after. Number 5, if there's a tie, you have to make another motion that will pass. Okay. Right, because the tie does make that motion die, so then I guess, yeah, it would have to be another motion. Okay. I'm assuming you're still typing unless you say I'm done in the chat. Okay, number 6. It seems there is more officers circling around each other and ignoring the public's concern, like during the failure to investigate stolen car last month. Okay. Okay, and then I can't paste into the chat. Sorry, this is taking so long. I can't speak because there's not a phone number other than for iPhones provided. That's all for now. Yeah, what is the deal with that, David? I don't get the iPhones provided thing.
I mean, it's the phone numbers. I mean, I don't know why he couldn't access that. I mean, it's a 10-digit phone number.
Would it, maybe this is weird, but in these kinds of situations, would it be weird for me to say that somebody could call me and be, I don't know, is that a thing?
You know, let me look into the iPhone issues thing, and I, all this will be fixed at the next meeting, so.
Okay. I think for now, Mr. Handelman, if you do want to call me for the next public comment, let me know and I can give you a number. Okay. We're going to go ahead and move on. Next person we have is Barbara Christensen. There you go.
I don't have access to all the documents, but just listening to everything, I would have to go not sustain and for a couple of reasons. I did think of the diabetic issue versus high. That was, I also thought when they're doing the evaluation right there, the rest, if my understanding with the fire department, that's a very preliminary health investigation. And the further investigation would have been the one that, is it Sylvan? Yeah, Sylvan's more concerned about, and I had to agree with both Julie and Taylor. So the report I wanted to see was that one that was done down at the jail, especially if the sling had been put on. So that, because it might also take time, you know, if you're putting someone's hand behind the back and you get a little too rough or bend it the wrong way or jerk it up and down, which they might not regard as an issue, could be an issue later on, so. It needs more evidence.
Okay, is that all, Barbara?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Any other public comment? And I have another one in the chat that I guess I'll read into the record as well. Marcel says, I have a hard time trusting the investigation when the officer presenting the findings is clearly biased and arguing in favor of the officers involved. Okay, and then I have Susan, you are up.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, PPP doesn't actually have to investigate further for you guys in an appeal. And then the complaint clearly doesn't prompt an investigation further based on what the commander said. And then based on what Sylvan said, the CRC doesn't have the safeguards in the system, it sounds like, to actually get the information to make a decision.
Well,
are you responding, Julie, or?
Oh, so, yes, but I don't know if I was supposed to be, so. But I will say that, I mean, it's not a matter of whether what we, I mean, they're sending something back because you feel like the case file is inadequate. And then there's making a determination as to whether a reasonable person could have made that finding. And the motion is that reasonable person could not have made that finding because there was insufficient evidence. So like, I think we're using evidence sometimes in this conversation in two different ways a little bit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I'm totally in the unsustained realm. I was making more of a comment that it doesn't sound like a system that is set up to be successful in deciding on appeals.
Okay. Susan, any further comments?
Nope, thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, last call for public comment, either in the chat or raising your hand. All right. Then I guess we, So Carl is asking a question. I have a question. What is the ramification of a not sustained versus unfounded? Unfounded was the finding that was brought to us. And so therefore, if we say not sustained, then we are challenging that finding. Maybe that's not what you're asking. Is that what you're asking? Did I read that right? Does somebody else want to add CRC? Okay. And then I've got, okay. Bear with us as this is our first appeal virtually and I'm trying to figure out what's good procedure here. There's a couple more comments. Somebody says, bam, she said it. This is where appeals get bogged down. Leah P says that. Rochelle Silver says the RU manager is not being a responsible person, as he said he assumes the officers follow policy. Carl is going to clarify. Dan Handelman says can't. I keep forgetting how to say your name. Bachigalupi? Bachigalupi? I'm sorry.
Bachigalupi.
Bachigalupi, okay.
There you go.
Said they didn't have the x-ray because non-medical people can't look at it, but also that the appellant signed a release form, so this is a contradiction.
Well, that's not exactly what I said.
Okay.
What I said is I don't know whether or not there's a distinction in releasing medical records versus stuff that couldn't necessarily be interpreted by non-medical people. So I don't know if you call and ask for medical records, whether you're supposed to get every single thing that exists or whether you get a summary of the medical information. That's what I said. I don't want it to be misconstrued.
Right. Okay.
I was the one who I think first, mentioned that I was really troubled by the absence of the x-ray. I didn't necessarily mean like the raw x-ray films, but just like an impression report, the way that we had for other things that were in the medical records. So, there would have been notes from the radiologist or even maybe from the next doctor who looked at it and reported back to the patient. There would have been records indicating, what the doctors had thought when they looked at the imaging. So that's that, would have been useful to us as well.
I understand. I thought you meant the actual images themselves.
Okay. We've got some more comments here and then we'll close up public comment. So this Rochelle Silver says the silence of 17 police officers doesn't make anything true. Carl Hickerson re-clarified saying, given that the original finding is unfounded and now appealed, what will happen with this case if the CRC finds it not sustained? What happens is that it will go to the captain or the chief of police. We have a conference hearing. That's the next phase after we challenge a finding. And so then we will have a conference with the chief and see if we can come to an agreement. And if we cannot come to an agreement, then it goes to city council. Am I not answering the question right? Or is that?
No, you are, but he could actually agree with our finding. And if he does, then there won't be a conference hearing.
Oh, right, sure, yes. So he could, yes, so he spend the challenge finding, he could agree right then and there, or if not, then it is a concern, correct. And then if after the conference hearing we still cannot come to an agreement, then it goes to City Council for a final vote. And that is where the buck ends. And they have the same standard as us. Sorry, go ahead.
I had interpreted the question from Carl as well as echoes Carl's question. Isn't the end result the same in either case? I had interpreted the question more as like, what's the difference in a practical setting? Like, does anything different happen for the appellant or for the officers? I mean, and especially given that the officers were unidentified. So maybe we could speak to that.
Yeah. I think it's difficult because we have an unidentified officer. So I think if we had an identified officer, then the situation, if with a challenge finding, if that were to, you know, go through, the discipline would be different, right? Possibly. I mean, that we're going from unfounded to not sustained. There probably would, we would probably add a debrief to that, or I don't know. It's also complicated because the directives were different back in 2016 and, yeah, so does that make sense? Did I answer that, Sylvan? Do you think I?
Yeah, I mean, based on my interpretation of the questions, I think that answers it. Like, you know, in this particular case, there might not be a large practical difference between the two findings that are sort of being debated. I guess that's the best answer I can give.
I guess it is more in principle than it is something that would necessarily change the outcome because there is no officer identified. And Christopher Cuttruff is asking who determines that the officer cannot be identified and what records are available to the public to confirm or reject that conclusion. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. Is that? Patrick Galupi, maybe you can answer that.
Candace, I didn't catch the whole question, I'm sorry.
Who determines that the officer cannot be identified and what records are available to the public to confirm or reject that conclusion?
Well, ultimately the investigator determines, the internal affairs or IPR investigators determine whether or not somebody can be identified through the course of the interviews and the evidence contained within the file. So, I mean, the police reports are probably all a matter of public record. The discipline files are not.
Okay, I'm going to take these last couple comments and then we're gonna need to move on unless CRC members want me to continue. Mr. Handelman says no discipline for not sustained. It would go on the officer's record and show that maybe the appellant was telling the truth rather than unfounded, which implies the appellant was lying. Another item I had ready to paste in was the question about whether the officer's notebooks were ever entered into the case file. And then Christopher says, so we're trusting to the cops to identify the cops who don't even want to wear name badges anymore. Okay. Okay, lots of comments. Any CRC, how are we feeling? Should we move forward?
I think I have a response to Mr. Handelman's comment about the notebooks. I believe that in the first time that we discussed this, when we just did the case file review, I had also been concerned about the missing duty notebook that was mentioned in one of the officers' interviews. And I believe we were told when I asked about that SCRT officers normally don't have notebooks or like didn't at this time. I know there's been a policy change that sounds not completely the same, but that might have bearing on that about, you know, the arrest reports afterwards. But I guess that's different. So I think it sounds like most of them would not have had notebooks to enter. I am still unsure about the one that, you know, said he did have a notebook and he just didn't, you know, present it at the interview. So that's, thank you for reminding me about that outstanding question, Mr. Handelman.
Yeah. Okay, I am going to close. Oh gosh, Julie, that's not great. So why don't we go ahead and move forward. So we're gonna close the chat here. Huh?
That was before I muted my phone, sorry.
Okay, let's go ahead and move into a vote then, because it sounds like we're gonna get close to losing quorum. Does that sound good? Okay. Let me pull up my sheet here. All right. Ready for a vote? We'll start with Taylor.
I vote to challenge the investigator's finding, and my reasons are because I don't believe a reasonable person investigating this could reach the conclusion that the claim was unfounded, meaning the allegation was false or devoid of fact, or there was not a credible basis for a possible violation of policy or procedure when 17 of the officers in the known universe of officers at the scene, not one of them remembers being the person to arrest him, nor is there without a specific description of the arresting incident other than it was a non-event. I don't think that's unfounded. I think a reasonable person could have found that the proper finding was not sustained because there's not enough evidence, I think.
Okay. Sylvan.
Yes, I'm going to vote yes on the challenge to not sustained for all the reasons I've discussed and that we've all been here discussing. I feel like it is an issue of evidence and that it's not reasonable to conclude that it, you know, happened or didn't happen one way or the other in absence of some of the pieces of evidence that I think are key that are missing. And that includes just sort of officers' memories. It'd been a long time since the incident. And that was mentioned in almost every interview in the record, so.
Okay, Jihan. I
vote no on the motion for reasons I've explained before. I feel that a reasonable person could look at the evidence in the file and conclude that it was unfounded.
Julie.
I'm going to vote yes on the motion because I believe that a reasonable person could not find that there was sufficient evidence to make an unfounded finding.
Nadine?
I vote no. The only contemporaneous evidence was that there was no shoulder injury, and the overwhelming evidence was that there was no shoulder injury during the time of the arrest, and certainly based upon that, the reviewing person could have found that it was unfounded, or was reasonable for the person to find that it was unfounded.
And then I guess I'm the last vote. And yeah, I really struggled with this, but I do think based on, I thank you everybody. I think everybody made really solid arguments for their decisions. And I truly respect everyone's position, but I'm gonna vote yes. I do think that the situation based on the conversation, and I agree with the assertion that there was not enough evidence in the situation to just claim it was unfounded. I believe that a reasonable person would have marked this as not sustained due to the many reasons described. I think Sylvan just said officers' memories. That stuck out to me too. And so, sorry, it's been a long day. I feel like I'm blabbing. I'm trying to summarize all the thoughts that I have, but I'm voting yes for all of those reasons, especially Taylor, your argument. I agree with that. Okay, so I guess it passes 4-2. So in this situation, since we are challenging it, it will be sent to the Captain of Internal Affairs to determine whether the Bureau will accept our recommendations. And then if the Bureau does not accept our recommendation, we will have a conference hearing with the Bureau, and the appellant will receive advance notice of that hearing. And then if we agree at that hearing with the Bureau, the case will be closed. If we continue to disagree, we'll schedule a case before City Council, and the appellant will also be notified of that as well.
Whew, thank you. That was a tough one.
Yes?
I said thank you, Candace. We'll, once we get that, we'll have the discussion with the chief and get back to the committee.
I appreciate you being here and truly appreciate your perspective. I know this was a tough case. Thanks for giving us your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you to everybody.
And I do double that. Thank you all for your time. I know this is very difficult and very time consuming. Every time we come to one of these, we do walk away with little nuggets of how we can do our job better. So thank you. Appreciate it.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Okay, and Julie has left. No worries. We still have quorum, yes? Okay. All right, well, we'll go ahead and move. Last thing on this is I usually ask, are there any policy training or quality of investigation issues the CRC would like to pursue as a result of this investigation? So I'll take some notes on that. I mean, I feel like I've heard concern about what we get back. Maybe Sylvan, did you want to add that to policy suggestion?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I'm not prepared with like a concrete specific policy suggestion that's like well worded and formulated at this point, but I do feel like just more, no, I'm going to say that wrong. This case did make me think about possible future cases where we might feel that an investigation didn't turn up everything that was needed, and I wonder what we would do about that.
Writing this down.
And to be clear, I mean, after already sending it back for, you know, reinvestigation one time, because I know that that's an avenue that's open to us, but then, you know, what about after that? So that's, I guess those are my thoughts.
Anyone else want to add any policy recommendations or thoughts?
I was glad to see that there was a change in the policy and that now reports are required when arresting by any CERT officer. That would have been a clear recommendation if it wasn't already the case, but glad to see that that's happened.
Agreed. Okay. Well, I guess we will move on to new and old business. I put post-retreat check-in on the new business just because, I guess, old business, because we agreed that we would add maybe a little bit of time after hearings. I think the only thing I really wanted to say about that was I think maybe we need to carve out some time for us to sit down and just talk about our system. And, you know, especially we have a lot of newer people, and just take some time to think about what our strengths and weaknesses are of the system and document those properly so that that can be given to IPR, it can be given to, you know, if a new ballot measure, if that ballot measure passes and there's a new oversight system. I just want us to be prepared and thoughtful about what we think, what we like and don't like about our system. So we can add that to another discussion. We don't have to do that right now, but I just wanted to put it on your radar that I think we should probably set aside a separate time to do that, as we're tired after 3 hours of an appeal, and I do not want to do that now, and I'm sure you all don't either. Sound good? And Vadim is gone, so we lost quorum. I think we just have to end it. Is that right, David?
Yes, we don't have a quorum, so we have to end it. Yes.
Okay. All right. That's unfortunate. That's unfortunate. I do have some thoughts, or I did want to report on crowd control. Maybe I can still say it. Can I still say it? It's just not on the record. No?
Well, the quorum is 5, so we cannot hold the meeting without a quorum, so.
Okay, I guess I'll just email it later.
Yes.
All right. I guess we just end. I don't.
Yes.
Unceremonious, no. But we're done. Okay.